the environmental impacts of our supply chains, women truckers move inside the beltway, and the demise of an iconic freight brand. Pull up a chair and join us as the editors of DC Velocity discuss these stories as well as news and supply chain trends on this week's Logistics Matters podcast. Hi, I'm Dave Maloney. I'm the Group Editorial Director at DC Velocity. Welcome. Logistics Matters is sponsored by Trevero Logistics. Trevero Logistics is an experienced Midwest-based freight brokerage firm. They have a national network of trusted carriers ready to meet your freight transportation needs. Visit Trevero.com and let their experts find you a solution. That's Trevero.com. As usual, our DC Velocity senior editors, Ben Ames and Victoria Kickham, will be along to provide their insights into the top stories of this week. But to begin today, this coming Monday, April 22nd, we celebrate Earth Day. Begun in 1970, this is a worldwide event designed to recognize the importance of preserving our environment. Due to its basic role of moving goods worldwide, our supply chains are among the biggest contributors to greenhouse gases. While we can't eliminate our environmental footprints, there are things we can do to lessen their impacts on the environment. Each year, CSCMP and the MIT Center for Transportation and Logistics produce an annual State of Supply Chain Sustainability Report. The project lead for this ambitious effort is David Carell, a research scientist with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Center for Transportation and Logistics. I recently spoke with him about sustainability in supply chains. Here's our conversation. Welcome, Dave, to Logistics Matters. It's good to have you with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, of course, we're talking about the effects of sustainability on our transportation and logistics systems. And, of course, being that we're in a political year and an uncertain economy, it's been a rough supply chain the last year or so. Are some of those kinds of events combining together to create some political pushback on ESG initiatives? And has sustainability taken a back seat?
That's a great question. I think, you know, speaking just to the data that we collect ourselves, I wouldn't call it a backseat. I would call it a plateau. So at least in the survey data we collect here, we see that in our last year of data collection, so the most recent year's report, collecting data from 2023, we did not see the growth in commitment to supply chain sustainability that we had seen in each of the previous 3 years. So we do see some evidence that there is perhaps a slowing of momentum or commitment to sustainable supply chains, but I wouldn't call it a backseat yet. I think it's more of a plateau, at least in the data that we collect ourselves.
What do you contribute as the reason for that?
You know, this is one of our most interesting findings, I think. When we ask people specifically about different things going on in the world that may impact their firm's commitment to supply chain sustainability, the only one that showed evidence of a negative effect was projections of economic recession. And so one of the things that I think we really have data to support, and many of your listeners may find this intuitive, but now we have some survey data to back it up, is that when people are worried about their downstream sales prospects, their commitment to policing their upstream for sustainability seems to wane.
But is that always involve a cost? Are cost savings and sustainability competing interests?
Gosh, that's a great question. And I think really it's a question that probably deserves a case-by-case analysis. Because, you know, on maybe the more obvious end of that argument, you would say, yeah, sometimes alternative energies, sometimes green technologies are a much higher upfront cost, and you just can't walk away from that fact. The other side of it, though, where I think one could argue that they act in tandem is twofold. One, energy efficiency efforts, you know, almost always save money. If we can conserve the energy we're using to perform the same operations, you know, we're saving both money and improving our environmental footprint. The other part of it, though, and this is one that we've brought into sort of the public discussion in the year that we're having, as you mentioned, there's some pushback politically on ESG efforts, is that You know, a sustainability program can protect brand value in ways that I think are sometimes underappreciated. One way I like to think about it is like the TSA at the airport. You know, we all put up with that because we hope that great crises have been avoided that we'll never know about because we preempted them with our security clearance efforts. I think the same thing can happen with supply chain sustainability and brand value. A brand doesn't know, you know, what horrible brand diminishing catastrophes could be out there in their supply chain. Things like child labor, things like environmental catastrophe, they could really diminish the value of the company. Supply chain sustainability efforts are proactive efforts to keep that from ever happening. And it's very hard sometimes to understand the cost benefit of that if we don't sort of accept that, sure, there's an upfront cost, but it may have forestalled something horrible and expensive from happening.
Dave, with the ESG initiatives that we do see in the supply chain, where are they coming from for companies to make sustainability more of a priority in their supply chains? Is that coming from their investors, from their owners, from their supply chain partners, from their customers?
You know, what's so interesting is that we have found that far and away the fastest growing source of pressure and the strongest source of pressure is from the investor community. So, you know, our survey goes out, just by way of background for your listeners, to around 3,000 people all over the world every year. It goes out in several languages, English, Spanish, Portuguese, and Mandarin Chinese. And we find by analyzing all that data that investors are the fastest growing and the strongest source of pressure. The respondents report that they feel to improve their firm's supply chain sustainability. And it's probably helpful for your listeners to know, you know, who does that beat out? It beats out government regulators, it beats out customers, it beats out current prospective employees. It really seems the story of recent years in supply chain sustainability is investor pressure.
That's interesting. And taking that into account, as well as some of the other limitations you mentioned, such as the economic pressure and political pressure that we're facing, what are the major barriers or disruptors that affect sustainability initiatives?
Well, I think there's two that come out of our research work so far, sort of put into big buckets. And one of them I would call clear rules. So we did a deep dive on the problem of tracking scope 3 emissions in this year's report. And as we talk to people about, you know, all right, well, what's so hard about scope 3? It's inherently difficult because it's your vendors, not, you know, the emissions that come inside of, that result from processes inside of your own firm. But it's also unclear to many companies exactly how scope 3 emissions should be calculated and who can book the wins when those scope 3 emissions are reduced by a vendor or a trading partner. So part of the barrier is just clear rules about how to book the wins and losses. Another one I think I would call, for sure, shorthand, clear playbook. So one of the take-home stories for me of doing this for the past 4 years is the great rise in the prioritization of social issues in firm supply chain sustainability efforts. But a conversation that has always struck with me since I had it is one of our executive interviews that we do to complement the data analysis piece. You know, someone said to me, okay, Dave, you know, I get it. Social issues are of increasing importance and I want to be sensitive to that. But then, you know, the CEO said to me, but I don't know how to make a more socially responsible warehouse. If you want a warehouse that consumes less energy, that consumes green energy, the playbook is clearer there. When we think about social issues, which have really become part and parcel of supply chain sustainability efforts, I think it's not so clear to firms what their first, second, and third steps are to become more socially sustainable.
Yeah, I think that scope 3 is a difficulty, especially with different regulations around the world. So how does someone navigate that?
Oh, the best answer I have right now is they need partners who specialize in it. You know, I mean, just thinking about the basic accounting and mathematics of measuring all of those emissions as things are moved around the world with different regulatory regimes, as you bring up, with different transportation technologies, with, you know, multiple vendors using the same vessels for moving things around the world. I think, you know, we need more research and everyone needs a partner to help them make those measurements. And then even more importantly, to make them actionable so reductions can be realized.
Right. And as some of that will become requirements, probably the sooner they get on that, the better. so they're prepared when it happens.
You know, that's a great point, and I wish we had the analysis ready at the time of this recording, but we don't. To answer the question, okay, so why are investors so hot, or why do we see investors as the fastest growing and strongest source of pressure? Well, one hypothesis is that the investors see those regulations coming down the pipe too, and they want the firms that they're invested in to be ready for that change. That could be the case. We're thinking of ways to sort of interrogate our data to answer that question, and we're going to work on that this year. But I think that could partially explain why investors are so prevalent in our results.
Makes a lot of sense. You had mentioned in the State of Supply Chain Sustainability report that you have just done that your research found that crisis situations often allow companies to reset their supply chain sustainability programs and goals. Can you explain what that means?
Oh, thank you for picking up on that, because that, I think, is one of our most counterintuitive and fascinating results. And it's also one that we've seen now multiple years in a row. So I feel really confident in the discovery, if you will, of this phenomenon. So the point that we're trying to make is that while you might expect in a supply chain crisis that commitment to sustainability suffers, in fact, the opposite appears to be true. Commitment to supply chain sustainability showed increases amongst our respondents when we asked specifically, how has the COVID-19 crisis impacted your firm's commitment to supply chain sustainability? We asked that for 2 years and got almost the exact same result. If a firm said that the COVID-19 crisis did impact their firm's commitment to supply chain sustainability, the vast majority said that it increased. We asked the question a similar way, and this was particularly true amongst our European respondents. Did Russia's invasion of Ukraine impact your firm's commitment to supply chain sustainability? If they said yes, the majority of the respondents who said yes also said that the commitment to supply chain sustainability increased as a result of these crises. So, you know, we really had to check the numbers, check the math. We saw this multiple years in a row, so we felt comfortable that this is right. We had to start asking people, you know, why? How could this be? Because I really thought, particularly, you know, with the COVID experience, that when we asked people about it, they would say, I don't have time to talk with you about sustainability right now. I'm dealing with, you know, all of the myriad problems that the COVID-19 crisis brought on families and supply chains. What we heard back in our executive interviews was, you know, look, the COVID-19 crisis broke my inbound supply lines. There were factories that I was sourcing from that I couldn't source from anymore. There were transportation vendors that I was relying upon that I couldn't rely upon this week. That gave me the opportunity to go to my leadership and say, look, I need time and budget to redraw our supply lines. When they did it, you know, in 2022, 2021, when we were seeing these results, people were redesigning their inbound supply lines with sustainability more top of mind than it was the last time this exercise was completed. So what we really found is that, you know, contrary to what one might expect, when the inbound supply lines are broken by crisis, be it the COVID-19 crisis, introduction of war and sanctions regimes from Russia's invasion in Europe, firms tend to increase their commitment to sustainability when they have to respond to that crisis and redraw their supply lines.
So in a lot of ways, sustainability can be done more easily than it may have been thought of, or that it actually can be a benefit to operations by going through the practice of redesigning or rethinking your sustainability programs.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, that reminds me of another executive interview that always sort of rings in my mind, is where we're talking about, you know, nuts and bolts. What did this look like at your firm? And the respondent said, and he was a former military person, he said, this gave me air cover to do the sustainability things that I knew I needed to do already anyway. And so he was talking about, I believe it was electric last mile delivery vehicles. You know, something they were thinking about. It was something that was maybe sort of a nice to have, but there wasn't a crisis that gave him the opportunity to ask for the time and budget to get that project done until the crisis gave him that air cover, if you will.
That's interesting. As you mentioned, you've done this study now for 4 years, the State of Supply Chain Sustainability Research. Have you seen any changes or evolving trends that have emerged as you interpret the results over those 4 years?
A couple things stand out, and I would invite all of your listeners who may be interested in checking out the report. You can get it totally for free at sscs.mit.edu. One of the things that jumps out to me is that rise of the social. So when we started this project, not everyone on the research team that we co-present this with the Council of Supply Chain Management Professionals and our many corporate sponsors who allow us to do this work and share it for free. Amongst that group, not everyone agreed that social issues were even part of supply chain sustainability. And there was sort of a tense back and forth, and the way we settled it was to just say, well, let's just ask. And if the world responds through their survey responses that social issues don't belong as part of supply chain sustainability, well, then we'll know. But the opposite happened. We really see strong growth amongst what we call the social dimensions of supply chain sustainability. Those are things like supplier equity and diversity, fair pay, fair trade, human rights. Those things are growing. And I think, at least for me, before I saw the data myself, I didn't know that the firms were taking them as seriously as part of their sustainability portfolios. And then that kind of leads to the second one. And I think sometimes this is maddening to our readers, but it doesn't make it any less true, which is sustainability is kind of a moving target, both over time and over geography. We see different priorities rise in importance and fall in importance both over time, but also as we divided the responses up into different parts of the world, we saw different priorities take precedence, depending if you're in the northern hemisphere or the southern hemisphere. So those would be my two big take-home points. The issues are changing and social issues are growing rapidly, and I think they're here to stay.
It is good to see that that coupling has occurred, but do you think in some ways that that may have hurt some of the sustainability issues to be part of the ESG with social being maybe more politically volatile?
Oh, that's an interesting point. I don't know that we have data in our survey to shed light on that, but I would say anecdotally, I think you're onto something with, what I read in the same sort of trade press that maybe your listeners read. It does seem that people may be afraid to go out to take their sustainability message out into the world when it has become so politicized, over the last 12 months.
Yeah, interesting. Anything else to share on this based on your research that you'd like to provide as final thoughts?
Guess I'd just like to share with your listeners that for me on Earth Day, it's a time to reflect on sort of the health of our planet. And sometimes when we do that, I think we can easily find ourselves maybe in a state of despair or a state of concern that we're not doing enough. I think that's probably true, but it can also be very helpful to have something that makes you hopeful on Earth Day. And the thing that I wish everyone who reads the report could have the same experience I do making the report, because I make it through cooperation with students from around the world, with companies from around the world, with our partners at CSCMP, and at all of these organizations, there are really, really smart, really, really hardworking people, many of them who give their time completely for free to help us do this project. And to me, that really shores up my confidence that sure, there are a lot of problems, but there are also a lot of really hardworking, really smart people committed to solving them too.
That's great. Thank you, David. We really appreciate you being with us today.
Honored to be invited. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to David Corral. He's a lecturer and research scientist for the MIT Center for Transportation and Logistics. Now let's take a look at some of the other supply chain news from the week. And Victoria, you wrote a story about new efforts advocating federal policies supporting women truckers. Can you share the details?
Absolutely, Dave. Happy to. So, members of the American Trucking Association's Women in Motion group met with federal government leaders in Washington this week to advocate for policies that support women drivers and that will encourage recruitment and retention of more women in the industry. So, just a bit of background, ATA, that's the American Trucking Association, their Women in Motion group is fairly new. It was founded last year with the goal of empowering the next generation of women leaders in trucking. And this week's 2-day event was the group's inaugural Call on Washington, so we can expect to see more of this kind of advocacy in the future. The group was made up of 18 women representing 10 states, and it included both truck drivers and trucking industry executives. At meetings on Capitol Hill and at the White House, they shared their experiences in trucking, and they also made the case for Congress to pass bills that will do a few things: foster safe and productive workplaces, reduce financial barriers to joining the industry, and also preserve pathways to entrepreneurship.
Well, Victoria, we've seen in the news quite a few proposals aimed at improving women's experiences in trucking. What specific legislation did this group talk about?
Well, I was not in Washington for the event, but ATA released a statement describing some of the efforts that this group discussed over the 2 days. And those issues included the Truck Parking Safety Improvement Act, and that would create a dedicated funding stream to build safe and secure truck parking. That's been a big issue for both men and women on the job, so we've heard a lot about that. Another one is the Bipartisan Workforce Pell Act, and that would help lower income individuals access commercial driver license or CDL training programs. Those can be pretty expensive. And the other one was a resolution to overturn the U.S. Department of Labor's independent contractor rule. This is a rule that was announced earlier this year that the ATA and other industry groups say threatens the independent contractor model, which is prevalent across the industry. We write often about independent owner-operators out there. So advocates of overturning the current rule say it would protect the more than 350,000 truckers, that includes many women, who choose to be independent contractors rather than employees. And they choose that for a range of factors. Most, you know, commonly, obviously, is economic opportunity and flexibility. So those are the three of the things that were discussed, and we'll probably hear more about that in the months and weeks ahead.
That's right. I know that independent contractor rule is very controversial, and we have written about that. We'll continue to track what's going on with it. Thanks, Victoria.
You're welcome.
And Ben, you wrote this week about exactly what happened to Yellow Corporation and what's happened since this iconic freight brand went under. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, glad to, Dave. You know, anyone who works in transportation knows that we've been living through a freight recession for the last 18 or 24 months. The overall economy on a national level is going pretty well, with new jobs are being created and consumer spending just keeps on going. And inflation is coming down slowly, maybe not fast enough for some. But in trucking, and specifically full truckload sector, there's too much capacity and not enough freight to go around. So rates have been low for a long time. That's been having a rough impact on freight brokers, like the digital freight broker Convoy that went out of business, and on carriers, most famously the fleet that you mentioned called Yellow, which declared bankruptcy last year. Yellow, you know, blames that result on contract negotiations with the Teamsters Union. The union says that the company spent more than it could afford to acquire smaller fleets and expand. But, you know, whoever is right, and probably they both have a point there, in the end, Yellow couldn't pay its bills. So there was, for example, outstanding a federal pandemic loan, and also it failed to keep up with its employee benefit plan. So now it's out of business. It sadly had to let go thousands of employees, and it's been selling off its assets to raise funds to pay those debts. And this week, we actually learned a little bit more about what's happening to those assets.
So, Ben, who's buying those goods and what kind of assets are they exactly?
Right. Great question. It's not just trucks. So the sale has been taking place as a court-supervised auction, and the buyers largely have been Yellow's former rivals. They've been managing to weather the storm, and if they're still around, they're getting a really good price on this stuff. It includes real estate, like freight terminals and trailer yards, as well as the vehicles themselves. So in fact, Estes Express Lines last week announced plans to open a wave of new cargo terminals. They include, it's not solely, but it includes property acquired from Yellow. But it actually makes the single biggest influx of terminals and equipment in Estes history. So, you know, to measure by the size of the company, this is a significant expansion. Specifically, Estes acquired from Yellow some 24 terminal sites, and that adds a total of 985, almost 1,000 doors to its network, as well as over 130 tractors and 6,000 trailers. Also, they got thousands of other pieces of equipment, things like load bars and airbags and freight tables, that are necessary to manage the freight. That actually followed some similar deals by XPO, another major fleet. They said last week as well that they had opened three new service centers. They marked the first sites that XPO had bought from Yellow since it acquired 28 locations in December. And likewise, Roadrunner said that it had opened a new LTL service center in Atlanta after buying and renovating a former Yellow property. So that new Roadrunner site, it actually sounds pretty swank. It's a two-building cross-dock facility with 75 doors. It has an on-site mechanical shop with three bays and an inspection lane. It has parking for more than 300 trailers, electric security fencing and gate access, and a driver lounge area with showers in it. So you can see that, you know, these other freight fleets, the ones that are still around, are doing well enough to invest in the future and upgrade these properties pretty nicely and hopefully create more efficient networks.
Well, of course, it's sad to see a company go out of business after so many years, like happened to Yellow. But like most businesses, the freight industry is survival of the fittest, and those companies that are the better managed ones.
It's true for sure. Yeah, it's a difficult road, but hopefully we'll come out of it on the other end, in better, more efficient shape for the industry as a whole. And but judging by this, maybe that trend is starting now.
Thanks, Ben.
Glad to.
We encourage listeners to go to dcvelocity.com for more on these and other supply chain stories. Also, check out the podcast notes section for some direct links to read more about the topics that we discussed today. And we'd like to thank David Corral of MIT for being our guest. We welcome your comments on this topic and our other stories. You can email us at podcast@agilebme.com. We also encourage you to subscribe to Logistics Matters at your favorite podcast platform. Our new episodes are uploaded on Fridays. And a reminder that Logistics Matters is sponsored by Trevero Logistics. Trevero Logistics is an experienced Midwest-based freight brokerage firm. They have a national network of trusted carriers ready to meet your freight transportation needs. Visit Trevero.com and let their experts find you a solution. That's Trevero.com. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Logistics Matters. Be sure to join us. Until then, have a great week.